For those of you who have seen the local speaking schedule and plan for this month, you may have noted that typically we have a Bible study at about this time of the month. We have been going through the Minor Prophets, and we're about halfway through the book of Zechariah. But I've really felt that given the time of year, it might be more appropriate to have a study on a different kind of a subject, more that is in harmony with the upcoming spring Holy Day observances. So today's message is mostly a Bible study, but it's a little different than we're kind of breaking the pattern from what we have been in terms of the Minor Prophet series. We are well into now our preparation for the Passover and for the Days of Unleavened Bread. Of course, Passover is preceded by a personal examination and an introspection and careful evaluation to make sure that we are honoring properly the sacrifice of Christ and living in a way that represents Him and what He's done for us. The Days of Unleavened Bread also involve some of that personal introspection, as well as the physical house cleaning, the removing of that leavening from our homes. Many of you have already begun that. Others of us are at least looking ahead to the joy of the extra cleaning that requires, and it gives us more time to consider as well the meaning of the day as we go through those physical actions and activities. Well, this morning I want to focus on a review of some of the history of that led up to and was part of the very first Passover and Israel being freed from Egypt. And I have a handout. Has that been distributed already? Okay. Everybody have a copy of the handout? Okay. And the handout is something I'm not going to take time to review in detail, but I think it helps to set the timing for what it is we're going to be talking about today. Whenever I read, study history, and even in the Bible, I find it helpful to have a timeline so that I can associate certain events with dates, and it gives more of a context. I think it gives a little more of a complete understanding. And so what I provided for you in this handout is a list of some key dates, starting with Abraham, and leading up to the year or the time of the Exodus. Now, I could have just gone through all these dates, but you know, and I do too, if I just start listing out dates and numbers and just reviewing history just by giving you a list of things that happened and when they happened, your eyes glaze over and they kind of roll back in your head, and it's all just too much information all at once. So I decided just to put it to you in written form, and you can take time to look at it later if you'd like. This is all part of the history of Israel, and the events that happened in particular at the leading up to and at the time of the Exodus are lessons that we're always to be reminded of. In fact, there's even a reminder of the Exodus that is embedded in the Sabbath commandment. If you look in Deuteronomy 5, there's a mention in verse 15 in the discussion of or the giving of the commandment regarding the Sabbath, a reminder about God rescuing His people from Egypt. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul lists several lessons that we, as the New Testament church, the New Covenant church, should learn from that time of the Exodus and Israel's experience in the wilderness. We're also reminded in Romans 15, verse 4, that we are to be comforted and encouraged by what is recorded for us in Scripture. It's intended to again, give us motivation and give us encouragement as we see God's hand at work in many different ways and at different times. So today, what I am planning to share with you is basically a Bible story. You know, we're going through a section of Scripture that tells a story or an account of in this case in particular, the life of one of the most significant men in all of history. That is Moses. Moses was the man that God chose to lead his people out of Egypt. We all know about him, and we know certain highlights of his life. I'm going to take this morning just to review some of those and to draw some lessons from his life that will be helpful to us in general, and I hope in particular as we look forward to the spring holy days. The title of the sermon is, or the study, is Lessons from the Life of Moses. So, to kind of frame the life of Moses, we could begin by reviewing a few key dates, events that took place prior to Moses that led up to and help us to understand the context of his life. The story of the Exodus actually begins in the time of Abraham. Abraham was given certain promises, and in fact, he was told that his descendants would be in bondage and would be released from that bondage at some point in the future. Now, this was before Abraham even had Sarah had given birth to Isaac, and yet the promise or the prophecy was already given. Just a few key dates, and since you have this in a handout form, I won't have to go real slowly through it. By the way, the dates that I'm sharing with you in this handout and that I'll mention are from a chronology that was developed by Dr. Ralph Levy. Dr. Levy is an instructor at the Foundation Institute. He teaches most of the classes on about the Old Testament books. Scholarly man. You've heard many sermons by him. We always appreciate his knowledge and his understanding. He developed this chronology. He labels it as an unofficial chronology. In other words, chronologies are a little tricky. The dates, if you check dates in one reference, it might be a little different from the dates that are given in another one. And they're subject to some change. So it's not as if he's claiming that these are the final word and that these are all things that couldn't be changed. There may be some adjustments even in the future. But these are at least close enough and general enough that we can use them as a timeline. If you look back at Genesis chapter 12, where Abraham and his father had traveled to an area called Ur, let's go to Genesis 12. I think I've got already misstating where they were. They were in Haran at this time. They'd left Ur and gone to Haran. Abram departed from Ur in 1897 B.C. And so that he was 75 years old, we read in Genesis chapter 12, verse 4. We find that the promise of the birth of a son was given to Abraham in Genesis 15, which we associate with the date of 1886 B.C. Genesis 15, verse 13 is of interest because this is part of the first promise that Abram was given. In fact, here in chapter 15 is when God establishes a covenant and changes that comes a couple of chapters later. This is where he makes a promise to Abram. And I just want to read a part of it here. Verse 13, God said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions." So this is a prophecy given in 1886 B.C. of the descendants of Abram and their enslavement and their rescue. It says they would come out with great possessions. The Exodus itself took place, as we understand, in 1443 B.C. So this prophecy is given way in advance of the time when that would ever take place. Genesis 17, we associate the date 1873. This is where God made a covenant, changed Abram's name to Abraham. And it says in chapter 17, verse 1, he was 99 years old when this covenant was made. So he had been then in the land of Canaan for 24 years, and this covenant is made with him. We might also notice, as you see in the handout, that in Galatians chapter 3, verse 17, Paul makes the comment that, I'll turn to it here, Galatians 3:17. That from the law, which was 430 years later, so in passing he makes reference to the covenant that's made with Abraham, and that the law was given 430 years after this event in Genesis 17. So 430 years from 1873 would take you to 1443. Genesis includes the account of how Israel came to be in slavery, how they came to be afflicted in the land, as was mentioned in that initial prophecy in chapter 17. We find that Joseph was sold into slavery. Genesis 37, verse 36, is the specific reference to his being sold to an Egyptian. This was in the year 1704 B.C. 22 years later, in 1682 B.C., we find Genesis 47, verse 9, where Jacob and the rest of Joseph's family join him in Egypt. So this was how the people of Israel came to be in Egypt, was through these circumstances. Joseph being sold into slavery, then there was the famine in the land, and Jacob and the rest of the family joined Joseph in Egypt. Genesis 50, verse 24, we find that Joseph died. He was 110 years old when he died. The year when Joseph died was 1611. B.C. So, just to kind of put this together a little bit, from the time that Jacob came to Egypt to the death of his son Joseph was 71 years. During those 71 years, when Jacob and the family came to Egypt, the people of Israel, the families of Israel, as they were growing, lived peacefully in Egypt. But after Joseph died, the relationship between the people of Israel and the Egyptians changed. There's a period of 168 years from the death of Joseph to the time of the Exodus. So during those 168 years, the people of Israel continued to grow in numbers. God blessed them with a lot of children, with families that were growing. The population was growing far faster than that of their host nation of Egypt. And the relationship between Israel and the people of Egypt deteriorated. Then we come to Exodus chapter 1, verse 8, where we find that another Pharaoh came into power, into his position, who did not know or did not remember, did not acknowledge Joseph. Now, perhaps he actually knew the history. I don't know that that was necessarily completely forgotten. But he did not appreciate or understand. He had no connection or relationship with Joseph. And this Pharaoh, seeing the rapid growth of the people of Israel, recognized that if this were to continue, they would far outnumber the Egyptians and possibly even take control of the nation. And so this led to the time of the oppression and the slavery. The people of Egypt began to dominate them in a very oppressive way, made their lives miserable, completely controlled them, and it kind of developed into a time of very difficult oppression for the people of Israel. There's no timeline is given. It just during this period of 168 years, it became worse as time passed. And again, because there was no real connection between the leadership later on and Joseph, there became a situation where that relationship was hurt. It's also notable that there was no person who succeeded Joseph in terms of being a leader of Israel. When Joseph died, certainly he was known by those of Israel. It was known that Joseph, this man who was an official in the Egyptian government, was one of them. And certainly he was, if not an official leader, then they would look to him for leadership. But when Joseph died, there was no one to take his place. There was no longer any Israelite who was part of the government of Egypt, and there was no real notable leader among them to help keep them together, so to speak, as a people, which probably made it even easier then for the Egyptians to begin to control the Israelites. In Exodus 2, you see the account of the birth of Moses. We'll look at that a little closer in a minute. Probably in the year 1523. When Moses was 40 years of age, he fled from Egypt and lived in the wilderness in Midian. That would have been in 1483 BC. And then 40 years after that, Moses returned to Egypt in 1443. In 1443 was the year when there were the plagues that were brought upon the nation, the Passover, and Israel's deliverance from Egypt, as recorded in Exodus chapter 12, verse 40. It mentions their departure from Egypt. So we find that the account of how Israel came to be in slavery goes clear back to the time of Abraham. And the promises that were made to Abraham began to be fulfilled then during the time of Moses. As important a person and figure as Moses is in the history of the nation, there really is not a lot that's written about him in Scripture. Part of that is his own fault. Because, you see, he wrote those first five books. He wrote the account of his life and included a few points of it in the early chapters of Exodus as far as the early years of his life. But we don't know a lot of detail. We do know quite a bit We don't know, I'm sorry, let me back up a second. We don't know much about those first 40 years when he lived in the household of Pharaoh, nor do we know very much about the next 40 years when he lived in the wilderness in Midian. We know somewhat more about the last 40 years of his life when he was leading Israel through the wilderness. So we find those three segments of his life: 40 years in the household of the Pharaoh, 40 years in the wilderness, 40 years leading Israel. But we don't find a huge amount of information about him in any for any of those periods of time. Go back to Exodus chapter 1. Again, we noted the bitter bondage that the people of Egypt submitted Israel to. Verse 13 mentions in Exodus chapter 1 that the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, is what it says in the King James. It means harshness. They had a very harsh and difficult life under the hands of the Egyptians. They were making the mortar and the brick from which many of the construction projects at that time were done. So they had no control of their personal lives. They were treated very severely, very harshly, lived in very difficult circumstances. In verse 15, we find that there was even an attempt to slow down the growth, or to actually discontinue the growth of the people of Israel by killing the boys as they were born, and by order of the Pharaoh. The midwives were commanded to kill any children who were boys that were born during that time. But the midwives, it says, were not willing to do that. Verse 17 says, "The midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive." And for that, it says, as the down into verse 20 and 21, God honored their willingness to preserve the lives, that the midwives honored God more than they were afraid of the king, and they refused to kill the boys as they were born. So Pharaoh, in verse 22, expanded his command. So now it was not just the midwives who were told to kill the young boys. He commanded all of his people. "Every son is born who is born shall be cast into the river." And so this Pharaoh was so desperate and so cruel, and this is kind of an illustration too of the oppression that the people were suffering, that he actually had all of the Egyptians bear that responsibility of killing any of the boys who were born to the Israelites. So this is the scene that Moses is born into. In chapter 2, verse 1, we read the account of Moses' birth. "A man of the house of Levi went and took a wife, a daughter of Levi." The fact that Moses' parents were both of the same tribe, of the tribe of Levi, certainly is significant. Later, when you see the responsibilities that God gave to the tribe of Levi within the nation of Israel. "So the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months." Now, we find, as this story continues here, that Moses had an older sister. Moses was not the firstborn in his family. In fact, we're also told later that Aaron was 3 years older. When Moses returned, he was 80 years of age when he returned from Midian, and it says that Aaron was 83. So Moses was apparently the youngest of three children. And his older sister, Miriam, she's not named here, but she's the only sister of Moses that is mentioned later. So we assume that she's the one in this story. played an important part. When Moses' mother could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank, and his sister stood afar off to know what should be done or to see what would happen. Then the daughter of the Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. This was a place in the Nile River that was safe. You know, there's a creature called the Nile crocodile, who is an especially dangerous and kind of a critter. But this was a place in the river where the crocodiles didn't hang out. Otherwise, no one's going to go down there to bathe. So when Moses' mother released him, she did so at a place that was safe and also at a place where he was likely to be found. So her maidens walked down to the riverside, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." None of us in general, in particular, the ladies, the wives, the mothers, are going to be able to resist caring for and taking into your arms to comfort a crying baby. And so she was taken by him. And we saw in verse 2 that Moses was a particularly beautiful child. We'll see in a minute a little more about that. But she was taken by him. And of course, the very daughter of Pharaoh, she knew what she was supposed to do. She was supposed to take him out of that little basket he was in and just dump him in the river to drown. But that's not what she had a heart to do. So she drew him out of the river, hence the name Moses, which means drawn out. And of course, the sister Miriam apparently was there to offer to find a nurse among the Hebrew women to take care of the child, and the Pharaoh's daughter told her to do so. And this is how it is that Moses' own mother ended up being given responsibility to care for him at this early stage of his life. So we find the story here of the birth of Moses, which I mentioned earlier, was in the year 1523 B.C. Now, I mentioned that there's not a lot of detail about the life of Moses in Scripture. There are three chapters that we're going to be going back and forth to read from, and you may want to kind of find a way to mark these three so that it'll be easier to flip back and forth. Here in the first three or four chapters of Exodus, we'll be reading there. We'll also be reading from Acts chapter 7, which is the time of when Stephen was martyred. He, in defense of his beliefs, recounted a brief history of the people of Israel, and it included some detail about Moses, and Hebrews 11, which mentions the faith of Moses and a few of the details of his life. So we're going to be going between those three chapters to piece together our understanding here of the life of Moses. So let's turn now to Hebrews 11, verse 23. Hebrews 11, verse 23. We just read this account in Exodus, but it says here that by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. The faith that is mentioned here is not so much the faith of Moses, because he was just a newborn baby boy, but the faith that his parents had. His parents had some faith in God and an understanding of the basic integrity of life itself, and they were not willing to submit to the king. They put their faith in what they believed to be the right thing to do, which was to preserve the life of their son. This helps us to see that while Israel had lost its way in general, the people of Israel, we know by the way that they lived when they were in the wilderness, the way they responded to the teaching they were given, they really had very little understanding, if any, of the covenant that God had made with Abraham, or the way of life that Abraham had lived in obedience to God. But there were individuals that God preserved who maintained a certain level of understanding so that they would be able to carry out and fulfill the plan that God was working. The statement made here that he was a beautiful child is in agreement with what we saw in Exodus chapter 2. Also in Acts chapter 7, verse 17. Acts chapter 7, verse 17, actually verse 20. Acts chapter 7, verse 20. At the time Moses was born and was well-pleasing to God. The language used in Hebrews 11, as well as this phrase used in Acts 7, indicates that Moses was a particularly beautiful baby. And most likely, given that attribute, that's because it would help those who would be preserving his life to choose to do so. He was especially physically attractive. That's one reason the Pharaoh's daughter certainly would have been willing to go out of her way to preserve his life. Maybe it's significant, maybe not. Scripture doesn't say that Moses was an especially handsome man, but he was an especially beautiful baby at this point. So again, he would be, it would be appealing to others to care for him. God, of course, looks beyond just the outward appearance. And although Moses was certainly a beautiful child, and by the way, who of us has not had children who were absolutely the most beautiful ever to be born, but Moses was well appealing in appearance, well pleasing in appearance, but God also saw even here in Moses that there was something that he could work with, something he would work with that was pleasing to him as well. He had the capacity to become the kind of man, the kind of leader that was needed, that the people of Israel would need, that God would work with. In Acts 7, let's back up to verse 17. Acts 7, verse 17, it says, "When the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt." The promise that God had sworn to Abraham was that his descendants would number as the sand in the sea, and that God would, through his descendants, bless all of mankind, all of the earth. So it says that the time of the promise, or the fulfilling of that promise, was drawing near. Moses' birth was not just a fortuitous coincidence. Moses, as we noted, was born of the tribe of Levi, and that is a significant heritage because of the responsibilities he would later be given. Moses was born to courageous and faithful parents who preserved his life. There's some similarities you might find to Hannah, who gave birth to Samuel, and her dedication to God and her faithfulness. God provided a special family for Moses to be born into because Moses was to be a special person. And when the time came for God to advance his plan by fulfilling the promises he'd made to Abraham, it would take a person with special skills to lead the tribes of Israel so that they could become the nation of Israel. It was time for God to move his plan ahead. So Moses was born at that critical and difficult time in the history of Israel. We might also just pause to consider, why was it that the nation of Israel came into existence under these circumstances? Abraham was in the land of Canaan. So were Isaac and his son Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons, and they were beginning to grow, and the tribes were beginning to develop, even while they were still there in Canaan. Why didn't they just remain there in Canaan and slowly over time grow in numbers and take over more land and become the nation of Israel? Why couldn't that have been the way that God did it? Why was it such a difficult and oppressive and miserable time, frankly, for these people? As we saw in Genesis 15, from the very beginning, God intended that Abraham's descendants would be in oppression and be brought out of the land where they were in bondage. It was God's plan to create his nation by miraculously rescuing them from the bondage of slavery. That rescue was to always serve as a reminder to the people of the power, of the mercy, of the promises of God. Had they just developed without any particular issues or crises, then they probably would have thought, well, it's because we're such a great people, because we're so special of our, in and of ourselves. God told them later that that's not the reason he chose them. They weren't better than other people, but they were the descendants of Abraham. God worked his plan in such a way so that it would emphasize his power and his glory and would always serve as a lesson to the people of Israel. You find all throughout Scripture that God reminds his people of what happened when Israel came out of Egypt. All the way from the time it occurred, clear into the New Testament times. Because God wanted even the New Testament church to learn that spiritual lesson, that God has delivered us as well from the slavery of sin, from the oppression of a sinful way of life. So God delivered Israel, created his nation, because of, or in that way, to teach the lesson that he wants us to learn. So I pause to note the first lesson that I'll emphasize as we go through this story. And in some ways, maybe it's the most important lesson that we can learn from this whole account. That is, that God's plan is intricate and he is in complete control. God is in complete control of circumstances to work out his plan. We see from the story of Israel that he started not just decades, but hundreds of years before this event to see to it that all these would come to pass. And he also prepares the leaders that are necessary to accomplish that plan. Joseph himself was a very special person in the way that he represented what would become the people of Israel to the leaders in Egypt, and then certainly setting the stage for the birth of Moses, as I mentioned, to parents who were faithful, courageous, dedicated, and willing to put their trust in God rather than fearing and giving in to the command of the king. I think this lesson is important for us to remember because we can look back over the last 30 years in God's church and wonder, what is going on? Why is there all this confusion? Why are there all these divisions? Is it just because of people making mistakes and going in the wrong direction? We see certain events that seem to be random or circumstantial. Why did that person have so much authority? And look at the harm that was done from it. We might look at those events and think, well, you know, things just have gotten out of control. Now, maybe much of what has happened is the result of mistakes that individuals have made. We certainly know that people can make mistakes and that sometimes those mistakes can harm other people. But the lesson is that God is in charge. And the lesson for us in particular is that Jesus Christ is the head of his church. And that God the Father, Jesus Christ, are working together to fulfill their plan for their people. God has not lost control. Jesus Christ has not lost control over the church. In our lives, and perhaps we do, perhaps we don't, we certainly can say that those who do live at the end of the age will live under the care of Jesus Christ. And he will watch over those and care for those who continue to submit to his leadership. Jesus is the shepherd described in John chapter 10. The good shepherd who gave his life for his sheep. And the one who will not lose any one of his sheep, except for those who choose to wander off on their own. So, God's plan is something that we can put our trust in, our confidence in. He will provide for and watch over his people through every age. He'll provide leaders who are uniquely prepared to lead his church and to carry out his will, just as he did at the time when Moses was brought onto the scene. We've been talking in the last few weeks some about the plan that God predestined, the predetermined plan that God laid out. It's based on his purpose, based on his pleasure, based on his will. He's been fulfilling it, and he will continue to. So, a lesson we can learn from what happened to Israel, and we have the advantage here of all this hindsight. We can see how it all started back with Abraham and then Jacob and then Joseph and then Moses. We can see how it all fit together in this perfect development for the nation of Israel. God will watch over and develop his plan in our age as well. Let's go back to Acts chapter 17 again. Acts chapter 17. Acts 17, verse 20. We'll pick up again where Moses was born at this point. Moses was born. He was well-pleasing in God's eyes. He was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. But then he was found, it says in verse 21, by Pharaoh's daughter, who brought him up as her own son. Verse 22, and Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and in deeds. Moses grew up as part of the royal family of Egypt with all the rights, with all the privileges that came with it. As the son of Pharaoh's daughter, Moses was next in line to become the Pharaoh. He was prepared to be the king over what was the most powerful, the richest nation on earth. He was highly educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, quote unquote. Doesn't say any further just what that training was or how it was that he was mighty in works and in deeds. Just read a little bit from the Adam Clark commentary. It says about this phrase, about the wisdom of the Egyptians, they were at that time the most intelligent and best instructed people in the universe. Philo says that Moses was taught arithmetic, geometry, poetry, music, medicine, and the knowledge of hieroglyphics. The reference to his words and deeds may refer to the way in which he taught the people of Israel and the miracles that he performed. Josephus, however, gives an account of Moses being general of an Egyptian army that defeated the Ethiopians who had invaded Egypt and drove them back into their own country. Now, many are skeptical of this particular supposed history that Joseph wrote. It's not certain. It's not something that's verified by any other account of history. But as one of the other commentaries points out, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary concludes that what Josephus says of his military exploits is hardly to be depended on, but when he tells us that his ability was acknowledged before he left Egypt, there's no reason to question his accuracy. So in other words, the JFB commentary says, well, we may not be able to prove what Josephus said, but there's no reason to doubt it either. The point is simply that Moses was a uniquely educated, trained man who was prepared to fulfill God's purposes. He was highly educated. He was a competent leader who was well known, renowned for his abilities and for his exploits. This is the first 40 years of his life. He lived in that environment. But we see as we continue that there are life lessons that cannot be taught by Egyptian scholars or by military experience. There were lessons that Moses would go on to learn then in the next 40-year period of his life. Back to Exodus chapter 2, verse 11. Exodus, the second chapter, verse 11. We come to a transition. Having received the education and established himself as a leader and the heir to the throne of Egypt, we come to a significant transition. Chapter 2, verse 11. It came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. First of all, remember again that Moses wrote this account. Moses is the one who gave us this brief summary of this circumstance. So it is an acknowledgement here that even though Moses had grown up as an Egyptian in the household of the Pharaoh, he recognized who his brethren were. He knew who he was. He acknowledged that he himself was an Israelite, that they were his brethren. Acts chapter 7, verse 23. Compare what it says here. Acts chapter 7, verse 23. When he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. So he knew who he was, and God moved him to establish or to reestablish a stronger connection with his people in general. You know, nothing is said about the time when Moses was living in Pharaoh's household, if he had any connection during those years with his birth family, so that he could maintain his heritage as an Israelite. Anything about that would fall in the line of speculation. But it seems possible, at least, that even as he was growing up in Pharaoh's household, that he had maintained a connection with his birth family, that he knew who he was. Don't know exactly how that would have happened, what kind of relationship they might have had. But remember that when Moses, after spending 40 years in the wilderness, came back to Egypt, he was told that his brother would be his mouthpiece, would work with him. And when the two of them came back together again, Aaron was pleased to see his brother. It wasn't as if they were strangers. It wasn't as if, having been separated from birth, they never knew anything about each other. But Aaron and Moses immediately began to work closely together. It seems to have been a happy reunion when Moses returned. We find that Aaron trusted in and believed Moses. So it seems as if they were not strangers. It just brings to mind some questions about whether it's possible that there had been that awareness and that connection rather than just absolute total isolation. Hebrews 11, verse 24, makes brief mention of the very same instance. Hebrews 11, verse 24. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing instead to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater than riches, or greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. After all that had been invested in him, all the privilege that he had enjoyed, all the wealth and the prestige and the power that he had as a part of that family of Pharaoh, Moses refused to remain with Pharaoh's family. This is, as we see in verse 24, by his faith. By Moses' faith, when he had the choice, when he came of age, when he was 40 years of age, he chose to disassociate himself from Pharaoh. He chose to be associated with the people of God. This brings us to another point we can make about another lesson we can learn from this account, and that is that we also must choose God's way. Moses gave up, walked away from, abandoned the opportunities that he had in order to become part of the people of God. That decision was based on faith. Though certainly not anywhere near on the same level, we must also have faith to choose God's way over other opportunities that we might have. We choose to recognize that what God has to offer is far greater than what Satan has to offer. Remember that Satan tried to tempt Jesus Christ by offering to share with him the vast wealth and power that Satan had. It's recorded in Luke chapter 4. Satan had authority over this world, over this age, and he offered to share it with Jesus Christ if he would just bow down to him, bow down to Satan. Of course, Jesus didn't take the easy way out that Satan offered, as Moses also was willing to make that, in some ways, the hard choice to choose to be part of the people of God, the people who were oppressed, who were dominated, who were controlled, who were slaves, rather than to choose the power and the prestige of the family of Pharaoh. In 1 John chapter 2, we're warned not to love the things of this world, because it says those things will pass away. So we too have, or must have, a deep and genuine faith in the promises of God in order to make that choice. Many would say that you've made a foolish choice, that you've chose a way that restricts you, that limits you, that hurts you, and you're not going to be able to succeed in this in life because of the life that you've chosen to live. But you in faith recognize that the promises of God are far greater than the temporary fulfillment that may be offered in this world in general. So let's go back to the story then. We're here in in Acts, well, we're in Hebrews. Let's look at Exodus chapter 2, verse 11. That Moses, we saw, went out among his brethren, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw that no one was there, he killed the Egyptian. Moses knew that what he was about to do wasn't right. He looked carefully to be sure that there was no one else that was going to witness. And it says that he killed the Egyptian. He didn't just stop the oppression or stop the beating or the mistreatment. He seems to say intentionally took the life of that Egyptian. Let's compare that to what we find in Acts 7. The same event here is described. Acts 7, now in verse 24. We just read 23, where he was 40 years old, and he chose to be among the people of his heritage, the people of Israel. Verse 24, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand. Moses thought that by taking this action, the defense of a fellow Hebrew or a fellow Israelite, by killing the Egyptian, would earn him the respect of the others in the eyes of his brethren, that they would appreciate what he had done. Of course, we know from the account in the book of Exodus that the next day he tried to separate, back to Exodus chapter 2, he tried to separate two Israelites who were fighting among themselves, and they said to him in verse 13, what are you going to do? Well, actually, Moses said, why are you striking your companion? And the answer was, who's made you a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? So rather than creating this trust, it actually created suspicion. And the people that he thought would turn to him turned away from him instead. But as a key thought here in Acts 7, it says that he supposed his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand. Moses somehow already believed that God was going to use him to rescue the people of Israel. God was going to use him. And Moses thought, well, the people will understand when they see me take this action. There are a couple of things that we can learn from this particular part of the story. Another lesson we can learn is don't get ahead of God. God, as we've already noted, has a plan. He's working that plan. But if we step in and take our own action to try to make things happen before it is God's intention that they should take place, then we get out of sync with what God is doing. And the result in this case was not a good one for Moses. Moses was not, he put himself in real jeopardy. Now, because he was rejecting the household of Pharaoh, he likely would have been banished from the nation anyway. But now he had to leave the nation of Egypt as a wanted man. Now he was guilty of having taken another's life, and so he had to flee under very different circumstances. Now, I say that Moses would likely have been banished anyway because we're going to get in a moment to this second phase or second 40-year period of his life. Very necessary, very important to Moses and his development as a leader. But Moses assumed that everyone else would understand that God was going to use him to rescue the nation. And he took action on his own. Another lesson that we can learn from what Moses has done here is to not be controlled by anger. Moses was angry at the plight of his family, of his brethren. And he reacted emotionally. Probably a whole lot of anger was built up inside of him, far more than just the one occasion that he had just witnessed. And he took out that anger. He was enraged at the mistreatment of his, of the nation, of all the people, in this one instance in particular. And he took out that anger, that frustration, by taking the life of that Egyptian. This was a part of Moses' character or his mind that caused him problems even later in life. That Moses had a difficulty controlling the anger. Often it was maybe justified, but it wasn't handled real well. He came down off the mountain after he'd been given the Ten Commandments on the tablets of stone, and he saw the people dancing around and celebrating in front of the idols that they'd built. And he took those tablets of stone and he threw them down against the idol and broke them. Well, yeah, he was furious that the people had so quickly returned to their idolatrous history. But probably not the smartest thing to do, to take it out by destroying the tablets that God had just given to him. He was told to speak to the rock and water would come from it for the people. He was so disgusted with those people by that time. They'd been traipsing around in the wilderness already for some period of time, and they'd been nothing but headache and frustration. And here they were, doubting God and not willing to have their faith and trust in God. And Moses was just fed up. So he took his rod and he smacked that rock twice. See, anger maybe was justified, but Paul said later, be angry and sin not. So, anger, as we learn, can be something that's, you know, at times it's justified. Anger is not wrong necessarily, but the way we deal with it, the way we express it, is something that God is very concerned about. It cost Moses very dearly when he lost his temper. At any rate, Moses has had to flee now away from Egypt. And we begin the second 40-year period of his life. And as you can see, we could continue probably about 40 hours talking about lessons we can learn from the life of Moses. Let me just very quickly talk a little bit about this stage of his life. Exodus chapter 2, verse 15. He fled into Midian. Exodus 2, verse 15. Pharaoh heard of the matter, and he sought to kill Moses. Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. He sat down by a well, and then this leads to him meeting the family of Reuel, also known as Jethro. And Moses then begins this phase of his life. During this time, Moses married Zipporah, the daughter of Reuel, and they have two sons. And we see in verses 23 through 25 that while Moses was there in Midian, the plight of the Egyptians in Egypt continued to grow even worse. Notice chapter 3, verse 1, and keep in mind who this is. Moses, the mighty military leader, political leader, trained heir to the throne of Egypt, was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. This is where he sees the burning bush. So this is after he has been here for 40 years. After 40 years, he doesn't even have his own flock. He's tending the flock of his father-in-law. His circumstances are certainly dramatically changed. Of course, the family structure was different then and different in that culture. But the point is that here he was, after 40 years, he was tending the flock of his father-in-law. You might consider that Moses at this point is 80 years of age. He's lived for 40 years as an Egyptian and for 40 years as a Midianite. He's yet to live as an Israelite because God is training him, preparing him for his opportunity, his role. God reveals himself to Moses in the next several verses here in chapter 3. Drop down to verse 11. Again, see, here's the lesson that Moses learned while he was there in Midian for 40 years. God had told him that he would be using Moses, verse 10, to release, to get, so that the people could come out of Egypt. Moses' answer to God was, "It's about time. I was ready for this 40 years ago, and finally you come around and tell me that now I get to go back and lead the people out of Egypt." Now we find a very different man here, don't we? Moses is not like that at all anymore. Perhaps it even reversed that assumption he had in the first place. Doesn't even view himself as one who could, based on everything that's happened, be the one who would lead the people out of Israel. Moses said, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" Moses, during that period of time, was brought down several levels, and he was humbled by the events and by his circumstances. He no longer assumed that he was the great man who would lead the people to their freedom. Continuing here, then, let's see. God said, "I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign that I've sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain." This was the very location that God brought Israel back to when he entered into his covenant with them. Moses said, "Well, who will I tell the people that you are?" He answered him in verses 14 and 15. Moses learned that he was not such the important person all on his own. And he was humbled, and he learned that he must rely on God's power, on God's strength, on God's intervention. A couple of miracles were performed, the turning of his staff into a serpent and his arm given leprosy and then healed, and turning water into blood. These were signs or miracles that God showed that Moses would be able to perform in front of Pharaoh. Verse 10, chapter 4, Moses said to the Lord, "O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before you, before nor since you have spoken to your servant, but I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue." Moses was a very highly educated man, but perhaps had difficulty expressing himself. What he said was important and proper. He was a word of mighty of words. He was a man who was mighty in his words, it says in Acts 7, but he wasn't comfortable doing so. So God told him that, "I will be your mouth. I will teach you what you will say." But Moses still argued, verse 13, "O my Lord, please send by the hand of somebody else, whoever else, to have this done." Well, God even became angry and frustrated at Moses. You know, he'd maybe gone over the line back to a level where he just was so broken and so humbled he wasn't even responding to God. And so at this point, God offered Aaron to help him accomplish what he would need to do. So lesson number 5 is pretty easy, pretty clear, pretty simple. And that is that we must rely on God's power. There's so many examples in Scripture of God accomplishing his work through men who yield themselves to him. We have many challenges, we have many opportunities, we have many times in our lives when we feel smaller than the circumstances. We can succeed in dealing with whatever God has put before us if we rely on His power. We learn not to rely on our own. The lesson of humility and of yielding to God and of accepting God's power to accomplish, to get through the circumstances at hand, is the lesson that Moses learned during this second 40-year period of his life. Then we come to the time that we know best. We're not going to spend any additional time because we know more about Moses in the final 40 years of his life because of the leadership that he has over Israel and the accounts that are given from Exodus on through the book of Deuteronomy. So we find that Moses then was a man who was able to accomplish great deeds or great miracles because of his reliance on God's power. Let's just look at one verse, Acts 7, verse 35. A summary of what happened when Moses yielded himself to God. Actually, verse 36, Acts 7, verse 36. He brought them out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness for 40 years. By this time, after being raised, trained, educated, and experienced in the household of Pharaoh, and then having experienced the other side of life, the humility and the dependence and the simple life by comparison of being a shepherd for 40 years, Moses had become the person that God could use. He had been uniquely prepared. He was groomed not just to be the king of Egypt, but he was groomed and prepared to be the one that God would use to create or to lead his people to become the nation of Israel. We find here then lesson number 6. That is our need for faith, humility, and courage. That's what Moses' character added up to after these events had shaped him. They're qualities that he learned, that he expressed as God developed them in his life. We too have many opportunities where we can grow in and exhibit the same. It will require of us deep faith, trust in God, a humble reliance upon God, and the personal courage to continue when situations are difficult. Those are the qualities that God built into Moses, and he will also build in our lives. So as we approach the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, there are many sections of Scripture that it's helpful for us to review. You could read through the gospel accounts of Jesus Christ. You could read through the instructions that Paul gave about keeping the Passover. You can read the chapters in Isaiah that speak of the suffering that Jesus endured. There are many sections of Scripture that are very relevant and apply specifically to our observance of these times. The life of Moses is something that we can consider as well. We can learn valuable lessons that will help us to prepare for our observance of the days that are ahead, and also lessons that will help us to prepare to continue through the opportunities and the responsibilities that God gives to each one of us. So, kind of a quasi-Bible study. Again, taking a break from our study on the minor prophets. There's so much we can learn from lessons that can apply in our lives that we learn from the life of Moses.